Hello, this is Eric Morse Eskenazi. I am the host of the Rag Dispatches podcast. Thanks for tuning in to this latest episode in which I interview Richard Kears discussing his book, Swindled by Faith. Hello, thanks for listening to the Erratic Dispatches podcast. We'll be back shortly after a brief break. Swindled by Faith, how long were you working on the, well, what inspired you to write a book about being in the move?
Well, I decided in about 2006, actually, to write this book. That's when I wrote the book. Mm-hmm. And it was just a process of time. I was going through a rough time in my life, and I decided to put all my thoughts on paper, and that's kind of how the book happened. Mm-hmm.
And how long did you work on the book for?
It was a process of probably 3 or 4 months.
Okay. Yeah. And how has the public reaction been to the book so far?
It's been pretty good so far. We've had people from all over the world that have contacted me, that have thanked me for writing the book. There's some negative response to it from people that were in the group, and particularly my family, that weren't too happy that I wrote the story. But in general, it's been absolutely amazing. The messages and emails that I get from people are just so unbelievable. It's just unreal.
And you're originally from Ontario, Canada?
Newmarket, Ontario, just outside of Toronto. That's correct.
Do you still live there, or I know you have lived in Jamaica, or do you still live in Jamaica?
Well, I'm in Edmonton right now. Okay. I do spend time in Jamaica, and my primary home was Victoria, and I'd like to move back there, but I just haven't had a chance. I've been too busy. So,
and have you written any other books?
Yes, I've written numerous books, actually. Okay. And I have a sequel to this one that's ready to come out.
Great.
Probably will be released within the next couple of months. And it's called Silent Voices, which is more, I interviewed about 100 people that have left different cults.
Oh, wow.
not just the move, but various cults, and talk to them about their experiences there and afterwards, and how they coped and how they dealt with life. And it's very interesting.
And are there a lot of support groups out there for people that were formerly in cults?
There are some. There's not a lot. I would say if you search, you can find them. There's a few of them on the internet. They're far and few between. One thing about cults is that the majority of people that are in cults or that have been in cults don't like to talk about it. And part of that is because you're indoctrinated while you're there, that you never talk about it. And people are afraid. People are very afraid to talk about it. That's a very common denominator with everyone that I speak to is, you know, don't tell anyone I spoke to you, and don't use my name, and, you know, make sure that you change the circumstances a little bit so I'm not identified. And it's unbelievable, the fear that still people carry years later.
But you seem pretty comfortable, though. I guess you're not do you feel like you suffered a certain sort of PTSD from your experiences when you were a child and the type of abuse that was subjected to you and what you witnessed?
I did. I think everyone that is involved in that does suffer from PTSD. It's one of those things that you either deal with it or you let it get you for the rest of your life. I'm comfortable simply because I don't care anymore. Mm-hmm. I just it's the story. It's what it is. And I felt that people needed to hear it because everyone needs to talk about it and let it out, because if you keep it inside, it just eats you up all your whole life, right?
Mm-hmm. I found your book to be very powerful, and then I also watched a couple of times that documentary, The Movement of God, in which you were interviewed.
Right. Yeah, that was quite interesting, quite fun.
And you come from a family, you had 7 siblings.
That's correct, yes. I had... there was 8 of us, actually.
Okay.
The last one was born after I already left home. So, okay. She grew up in the group, and she was born there and left, I think, when she was around 18.
Okay. Do you presently still have relatives or family members in the move?
No, not well, just I have an aunt and an uncle, I believe, that are in there, but that's about it.
Okay. And I know you mentioned, like, in the book and also in the documentary, that there was like a strict dress code and personal, you know, you had to have a personal appearance. There was like a lot of rules, like how you kept your hair length. You couldn't have like facial hair.
Well, generally with men, it was you had to have very short hair. You mm-hmm. couldn't have a beard or mustache. You basically were never, you know, shorts were something you were not allowed to wear. There was a pretty strict dress code. With the girls, it was a little bit tougher. I mean, their dresses had to be at least 2 inches below their kneecaps. They weren't allowed to ride horses because they weren't allowed to wear pants. So there was really strict rules about, yes, about attire and that type of thing as well, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you weren't allowed to celebrate holidays and birthdays.
Well, it wasn't, I don't think that we weren't allowed to celebrate them. It's just that we were told that they no longer existed. So religious holidays were pagan. They were satanic. Christmas, Thanksgiving, those types of things were all evil. Mm. And birthdays became irrelevant, just like education became irrelevant. You didn't need to have an education because we were needed on the farm, and the world was going to end anyway. So why would you need an education, right? Mm-hmm. So they had their own theory on all of that stuff, and it was pretty weird.
It seems like other cults I've read about. Like, I interviewed a journalist a few months ago who was at Jonestown and met Jim Jones, and about other cults. You know, it seems like there's a lot of emphasis within cults about the apocalypse, about the end of world coming, and I wonder why that is. I mean, in your cult, were you allowed to read like the New Testament, like the book of Revelations, which focuses a lot about that?
Well, actually, in many religions, they only believe in the New Testament. Many mm-hmm. believe in just the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. Ours was pretty well the whole Bible. Mm-hmm. But apocalypse was a very important thing. And understanding religion is very much like politics. I mean, you can be controlled only if you're afraid. Mm-hmm. And so the reality of it is the more fear you can create, the more you can control the masses. And in this religion, which is the same in every cult that I've researched, they always talk about the day that the world's going to end, and you have to be right with God. And the only way you can be right with God is to conform to the religion that you're in. And so, and they make you conform based on that fear. Mm-hmm. So we see that today in politics and it's exactly the same thing. It's like the more fear that you can instill about, oh my God, we're going to go to a war, or we're going to do this, or the world's going to be destroyed by nukes. It's the same thing in these religions. It's all about the end of the world and where do you go in the afterlife. Mm-hmm. And they create an afterlife that is absolutely terrifying if you aren't on the right side of the religion.
Did you have like a lot of nightmares as a child because of with the different descriptive stories they would share with you about what would happen if you sinned?
I had a lot of nightmares as a child because if I think back, I really actually believed a lot of the stuff that we were taught in the earlier years. I remember there was this one preacher that came to the town near where we lived, and we went to hear him, and he preached that three people in the audience were going to die within 3 days if they didn't get right with God. Mm-hmm. And I think I was about probably 10 years old at the time, 11 years old. And I was absolutely convinced that I was one of those three people. And I cried and I was terrified for 3 days. And I lived. And I couldn't believe that I lived because I wasn't perfect. I knew I wasn't perfect. And I thought for sure that God was going to strike me and kill me. And I remember that as being one of those scariest 3 days of my entire life.
And in your book, you mentioned like what the turning point was where you started to stop being religious, started becoming cynical, is when you witnessed a 9-year-old girl be sexually assaulted by teenage members.
Well, that was one of the incidents. I mean, there were lots of reasons why I started to be cynical. My cynicism really started when my dad became very sick, and we would hear him cry at night or even during the day, crying and moaning, and he was in so much pain. And I still to this day don't know what it was all about. But he wasn't allowed to go to a doctor, and we were told there was a good chance he was going to die because God was testing him. And that was when I really started questioning, why would God, if he's a God of love, if he's a God of, considering people and humans, why would he do something like that just to test you? It didn't make any sense to me. And I started questioning it. And yes, the sexual assault on that particular person, that was an incident that I knew about it. I was 11, and I actually was part of even organizing the fact that it happened, but I didn't really know what was going on, and I was kind of used. I felt guilty about that for many, many years, but when I realized that what was really going on, that's when I spoke up, and I ended up just getting into trouble for speaking up. So that was the way it always worked. There always had to be someone to blame. There always had to be, and they blamed the wrong people. The boys that perpetrated that, they simply got away with it, and it was brushed under the rug. And we don't talk about it because it's going to affect the church. It's going to affect the people. You know, we have to forgive. Well, I'm sorry, I don't believe in that. So my whole life has now been more about speaking out about those kinds of things. And the next book that's coming out, actually, really, I was shocked how similar the stories are from one person to another. And I've spoken to people from Europe and the United States and Australia, and it's all the same story, not the same group, but the same story: sexual abuse, physical abuse, fear, living in fear, scared to talk about it, told not to talk about it. It's just the same story over and over and over again, and it's really sad.
Yeah, and then I was reading the different stories about victim blaming. There was a lot of physical abuse, you know, with that, or to beat the demons out. They felt that you had issues.
Exactly. Every single situation, every single circumstance was the responsibility of Satan or demons. There was an easy out, which was just the laying on of hands, casting out the spirits, getting rid of the demons, which realistically I don't believe solves a problem. I think that a lot of mental issues and a lot of psychological issues that people had were just brushed off and never dealt with properly because it was some evil force's fault. And so bad things would happen and nothing was ever done to resolve it.
And there's also, like, I guess, a lot of backstabbing too. Like, someone could just out of the blue, like, accuse you of something that you were not guilty of.
Well, when I was about 13, about 14 years old, there was a girl that I liked on the farm, and we weren't allowed to like girls. And the father found out that I liked her, and he actually called me into what they call an elders meeting, which is where all the elders of the group get together. He had me called into this meeting, and he outright accused me. He said, I walked in the barn and Richard was masturbating the bull. Well, what the heck? Like, I've never in my wildest dreams would have talked or even thought about something like that. And he said, but God spoke to him and told him that I was gay. Mm-hmm. And being gay on the farms was, you were doomed to hell. I mean, that was one of the sins that was unforgivable, and there was nothing you could do. You were just going to hell. And so my dad even was sitting right there when he said this, and my dad just sat there with a smirk on his face, and he never did anything about it. And I thought of all the people that I should have depended on was my dad to stand up for me, and he didn't. And it was one of the elders afterwards that actually came to me and said to me, don't worry about it. He says, I don't believe this. You're fine. And believe it or not, that particular elder, they ended up leaving the farm not too long after I did. So it was kind of they actually left shortly before I did. So yeah, that was, so I think there was some people that there were definitely people there that were starting to see that it was wrong and figuring things out. So he had he just basically put his arm on my shoulder and said, don't worry, it's no big deal. But nobody said to me, we believe you that it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. You know. So it's really weird.
I guess it was like a lot of fear amongst everybody there.
It's all based on fear. It's all based on fear. And it, ironically, what's really funny is when you talk to people that are still in the group, because I still know a few that are, and I've talked to them, they don't believe they live in fear. They believe they live in a utopic society that's wonderful, where everybody loves each other and everybody cares for each other. But in every conversation you have with them, they talk about the end of the world. And now that Donald Trump is in, oh my God, the world's going to end. And, you know, and God, this is God, God's way of, you know, ending things, and the apocalypse is now closer than it's ever been. Well, I've been told that since I was 10 years old. I've even given, I think we were given at least 4 or 5 dates over the years, specific dates that the world was going to end. And it never happened. It was God changed his mind every single time. So, but people don't look at that fact.
And as a kid growing up there, you weren't allowed to be exposed to any kind of like popular entertainment, like films and music and television?
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing at all. There was no exposure to the outside world. We had no television, no radio, no books, nothing that was from the outside world. And the only thing that we did have was for toilet paper, we used newspaper. And so when they would do a town trip, they would go into town to pick up supplies. They would go to the local newspaper print shop, and they would pick up all the old newspapers, like stacks and stacks and stacks of them, and bring them back to the farm. And we would tear these newspapers up into little squares and put them in all the washrooms. But the point is that I used to take a few of those newspapers down to the barn, and I hid them in my little room down at the barn. And I used to read, and I would read and read and read. So I knew there was a world out there, and I knew that things were not as bad as we were being told they were. And even though the media tends to be fairly negative all the time, even back then it was always the negative stuff you read, but there was also good stuff. So you could see that the world was actually quite okay, you know.
Prior to Sam Fife starting the move, I know that he was like a country singer, country western singer.
Well, he did some country and westerns. I don't know a lot about him prior to the move, but I know that he did. He was a singer. He had a guitar and he sang. I don't think he really ever made it big time or anything like that, but he did some singing. Yes, he was a Baptist preacher.
Did he ever like sing his like own original songs? Like, did you ever have any exposure to that, or was the movement like made to like recite any kind of songs that he wrote?
No, not that I know of. I mean, some of the music we sang was original, and it may have come from him. I just don't know. I don't know.
So it was called like also, I guess prior, before it was called the Move, it was also called the Body of Christ and the Movement of Christ.
Yeah, it was, even when I was there, it was referred to as the Move, and it was also referred to as the Body of Christ. So it had a couple of different names that were, and it was the Move of God or the Move. There were, but when you had asked them what the actual name of the religion was, they would say, well, it has no name because it's generic, right? Mm-hmm. But that's what it was referred to, was the Move.
And then in your book, you mentioned there were these different like dates that were supposed to be the doomsday, like 1975, 1982, 1996, and 2000.
Yeah, exactly. And those were specific dates that we were given, that the world was going to come to an end. 2000 was because of the Y2K. 1975, I remember my dad had a dream and someone had paid him for something with a $75 bill. And he translated that into meaning God was giving him the date of 1975. And that went all over the group. Like, everybody believed it was going to end in 1975. And then when it didn't, then you got the next date and then the next date and the next date. And finally, years and years later, when my dad was pretty much on his deathbed, I asked my dad, I said, whatever happened? Like, I just don't get it. And he said, well, you know, God's people were just not quite ready. Mm-hmm. That was, and I thought, well, that's a pretty good excuse, you know? So
when you like, when they had to do different years as a doomsday, would they stockpile on like on clothes just to get ready for it?
Well, we always had stockpiles of a lot of stuff. We had stockpiles of groceries and stockpiles of clothing and stockpiles of everything we needed. I mean, you also have to understand that we lived out in the middle of nowhere. We had a pretty big farm, so we grew a lot of potatoes and basically turnips and a lot of stuff that you could keep through the winter if you had a root cellar, and which we did. We had a few big root cellars, and then they did lots of lot of meat, smoked meat, dried meat, that type of thing. For we had a big so, and then we had farm animals as well, as you could go out and hunt for moose and deer and stuff if you needed it to eat. So there was a lot of food out there if you needed. You could survive for a long time. But they believed that the world was going to be ended by a nuclear bomb, mm-hmm. With nuclear warfare with Russia, or with, they figured Russia, it was going to be Russia. And that we would be in northern BC or wherever these farms were, because they're all over the place. They were in the States and everywhere. But the ones, everyone on the farms were going to be okay, and because we were where God wanted us to be, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't even know. Like, I never asked my dad. I was going to ask him after the Cold War was over what the plan was for this nuclear bomb. Now I wouldn't. I hear from a lot of people that they're really scared that Donald Trump's going to be the one that's going to do it. So there's always somebody that you can. That you could pass this off on and say, "Oh, now we're still so they're still worried about a nuclear bomb coming, because that's what they've been told by God." So,
You were very detailed in your book about all the hard labor that, you know, people went through, and like the long hours and through like many accidents that happened.
Well, originally, when we first moved up to the farm, we really didn't have a lot of equipment, and we had a several kilometers of road to build, and there was no road, there was no, so everything was done by hand, so axes and shovels and chainsaws and that type of thing. It was very, very hard, and at 12 years old, I mean, I would imagine that an adult person could have handled it no problem, but there was quite a few of us that were under 16. And we had to work just as hard as the grown men. And in the summer, I don't know how familiar you are with Northern Canada, but in the summer, it gets light at 3 a.m. and it gets dark at 11 o'clock at night. So, and the summer is only 4 months long. So you literally have to work every hour of every day to be able to get the work done that you need to do in the summer. Otherwise, everything just freezes up. So it was a pretty tough, it was pretty tough. It was hard work. It never ended. From my opinion, as a child looking at it, I felt like it just never ended. I remember crying myself to sleep. I was so tired and I couldn't sleep because my bones and legs hurt so bad. But yet we had to get up in the morning and go do it again and go do it again. The one reprieve was the fact that they were very adamant about not working on Sundays. So we always had Sunday off, which was kind of nice. And I mean, there were still things to do on Sunday. You had to put in firewood and you had to do things like that, but it wasn't a hard labor day. So that was one thing on the farm that was, you always look forward to Sunday. So,
And you mentioned about these different farms, like a blueberry farm and Ram River farm. And sometimes you would stay at other farms with people. That was sort of like a break, you know, from your family.
Well, I mean, I was sent to Graham River Farm for a little while because of the fact that I had I was a rebel, and I was basically bucking the system, and they felt that if I went there, I may get a chance to change, right? And that didn't happen. I didn't. It didn't change my opinion. I still wanted to get away. But no, it was never like a holiday or anything like that. It was just it was one of those. Usually, if you were sent to another farm, it was almost like a punishment. You were sent there because you were doing something wrong and you had to be changed, you know. Mm-hmm. So some people, I remember the one that I was telling you about, the dad that thought I liked his daughter, and after he accused me of being gay, nothing happened. So they ended up sending her to another farm, and she spent, you know, a lot of time at that other farm, many, many, many moons at that farm. I would say, I think she was probably there for about 6 or 8 months. Just to get her away from me. And while she was there, she was sexually assaulted by two young men there. So, and she told me that years later, and repeatedly sexually assaulted the whole time she was there. So it didn't help to send her there. But they never thought about the child. They always thought about themselves and their own agenda.
And in the book, you mentioned about like a failed suicide attempt, and that you had to like hide the rope, like I said, rope marks or rope burn around your neck so other people wouldn't discover what you did. Were there anybody when you were involved in the move that actually like had successful suicides?
I know that there were a few suicides after I left. The majority of the suicides that I know about were people that left and then after years or a period of time being off the farm, just couldn't take it anymore and they ended their life. I know that I spoke with people that have been in the move, and we've written down the names of the people that we knew that were in the move that have committed suicide, and the numbers are so outrageously crazy. It's unbelievable in percentage of how many people have done that. It's a long list of people that have committed suicide or overdosed on drugs or things like that may not be deemed a suicide, but it is a way of, you know, you're depressed, you're dealing with a tough time, so you take too many drugs and you die. It's not always deemed a suicide, but in most cases I think it really was. It was just a giving up, you know. Mm-hmm. I know what it's like. I know how it feels to feel. I lived in fear for years and years and years and years. I was scared to drink wine because long after I left, I didn't even believe in the move anymore, and I didn't even believe in that God anymore, and I still was scared to drink a glass of wine because I thought I'd go to hell. I was terrified of hell for years.
Mm-hmm. Did it take you a long time to adjust to this regular society when you left the move?
I was lucky because I ended up living with a couple that were sort of on the brink, on the edge of the move. They were sort of in and sort of not. And they took good care of me, and they gave me a job, and I made my first, I was able to buy my first car with money I made there. And they were really, really awesome people. And so I was lucky in that aspect. So adjusting for me was a slow process because I lived with them for about 8 months. And then I finally, I transitioned slowly into my own place. And then I had a rough time. I was by myself at the age of 16, trying to hammer out a living and have my own place and be by myself, feed myself, take care of myself. It was a difficult life, but I had a brother at that time. We shared a place for a while after he left. And so we kind of helped each other along the way for a while. And that were, he was pretty good to be around, and he was strong, and he had been in the move for a lot longer than I had. He had stayed in it when he left the farm. He lived in one of the houses, that the communal houses, but he ended up leaving the move as well and has done very well for himself. So, you know, most of the people that in my family, most of my family has done okay. They've done okay for themselves in the readjustment. You know, they've got accountants, we've got business managers, we've got real estate agents, we've got, you know, so they all seem to do, most of them seem to be doing fairly well.
Were there like any particular writers that inspired you, like once you started discovering, you know, fiction writers?
Geez, not really. I read a lot, but I don't really pay too much attention to who wrote what I'm reading. I definitely, there's no specific writers that I aspire to. And because I write so many different genres that I write political books, I write self-help books, I wrote this autobiography, and I've written children's books, and I've written two novels, and so I kind of just, I'm all over the place with this stuff. And
like, I guess they were, at the time, there were over 4,000 members, I guess. Was that the max of how many?
Oh, no, it was, at the time that I was there was over 40,000.
Over 40,000.
Yeah, all around the world. They were everywhere, from South America to Europe to Alaska, all over the States. I'm not sure about Australia, but I know there were groups all over the place. I mean, it was now I believe it's down to, the latest number that I heard was around 2,500 people. So it's but I think a lot of the younger people, a lot of the people my age and younger, they didn't stick around. They left. And so it's a lot of old people and some very, very young people. And that's about it that's left. So
they were operating, I guess, like 40,000 acres of land.
The amount of land, I'm not sure. I really don't know. At the time that I was there, we had the three farms that were all basically connected, mm-hmm. and it might have been about 3,000 acres that we had that we were involved with. But yeah, they have land all over the world. They've got lots of land in Alaska and in the States, in Maine, and places like that. They've got places in South America. So I know they do have a lot of property and land at this point in time.
Are they still doing the same thing where they don't adapt to any kind of popular culture, or do they not use like technology or the internet?
From what I understand right now, they do use computers and they have phones now. They also have television now, which they never did when I was there. So they have changed, but their basic the basic rules of life, like how you dress, how you treat people, how you act, are exactly the same. Their discipline, ideas on discipline of children is the same. Everything is the same. That part hasn't changed. They even have their own schools now where they actually bring outsiders in to educate people in their schools. So it's become an interesting kind of evolution of the whole organization.
Do they have any kind of like online presence, like a website, or they use social media?
That I don't think so. I have not seen it, and I've paid attention to that. I have not seen it.
Hello, thanks for listening to the Erratic Dispatches podcast. We'll be back shortly after a brief break.
Like if you were to go to a rural area in Canada, like could you easily spot like people that were involved in the move without having to talk to them, or is it kind of hard? Are they
if I go to the towns where these people are near or close mm-hmm. by, I would know immediately if I seen them, absolutely. It would be very easy to tell, yes.
Just by the clothes they wear?
The clothes and the way they act. Mm-hmm. Very, they avoid people. They try to stay just to themselves. The girls are very, very shy because they're, you know, so they kind of huddle. And mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever been to a Mennonite or Hutterite community or seen those. It's the same exact kind of, they don't dress the same, but they all have that same persona around them. So it's about just not wanting to be part of the world. And they literally stand out like a sore thumb. They don't fit in, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I could say is equivalent to like where I live in Brooklyn is like groups of Orthodox Jewish, you know?
Yeah.
Towns are like that. You know, they wear certain clothes and it's all about being modest.
Yeah, exactly.
Not socializing with people outside of your group.
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, it's just a completely different approach. Like they don't blend in at all.
Mm-hmm. How did you get involved in the Movement of God documentary? Were you approached by People Magazine or Discovery?
Well, what happened was a friend of mine had asked me if she could post a couple of statements of mine on her blog. And so she did. And I received a phone call from People Magazine, and I received an email through my business account. I had a business, and I received an email one morning from People Magazine, and I couldn't figure out what the heck is People Magazine, and they said they just asked me to call them. And so who says no to People Magazine, right? So I phoned them, and they said, you know, we've read this. Are you the author of this book? And I said, yes, I am. And they said, can we get a copy of the manuscript? So I said, sure. So I sent it to them, and it was just a couple of days later that they contacted me back and said, we'd like to fly you to New York and do this documentary. We're working on this documentary and we'd like you to be a part of it. So I went, I got on a plane and flew there and did the documentary. It was very interesting and a surprise. I never expected it. So it ended up on Discovery. And you've seen that documentary. It is really very accurate. They did a really good job with that, and it does tell the story from my perspective, but also from the perspective of a couple of other people that they've interviewed on that. And at the end of the day, though, it really does expose what that group was all about.
And did you meet the other ladies that were interviewed in the documentary? I think one of them had written a book as well.
Yeah, I have never met them, but I have spoken to them on the phone, and we do communicate on Facebook as well. So we do have some dialogue between us, yes.
And you said, like, the, you know, you got a lot of reaction from, how about from the documentary? Did you get people contacting you of the documentary, or have you been interviewed as well in other documentaries about former cult members?
I have been interviewed many, many times right now, but mostly just the same thing as you, either radio interviews or just blogs. Mm-hmm. I was asked about another documentary that is being trying to be put together out of California, and I may be part of that one. I don't know for sure yet. The thing is that I was told that there's going to be an actual mini film made, and they want me to be a part of that. So I'm very excited about that. I'm very interested. I'm hoping to get my second book published prior to that, so that I can sort of help, you know, get a little more information out there, and maybe even they can talk to some of the people that I've interviewed, because there are some that have stories that are just absolutely way worse than my story by a long shot. And the fact that they survived, I just don't know how, you know. The real bad thing about it is, the sad part of it is that I interviewed an equal amount of men and women, pretty well an equal amount. But the women's stories are just absolutely horrific. The men, a few of them, yes, they had a really bad time. There was lots of sexual assaults with little boys when they were boys. And the stories are really, really horrific. But the women were treated so terribly. It's unbelievable. And not just the sexual, but the physical, the psychological abuse, the work that these women had to do. I remember in the kitchens, our kitchen particularly, I mean, if you're serving, you know, 100 people for breakfast, you've got to have several people in the kitchen making breakfast at 5 in the morning, because everybody's there at 7 to eat. And they had little girls that were getting up. Little girls would be getting up, and they were told, work, work, work. And they had to work in the kitchens just like a grown woman. And that was really tough. And if you didn't do as you were told, you got spanked and you got beat up. And the stories are horrific. And then talking about the parental aspect in the move is that parents give up their rights to their kids. They're still your mom and dad, but your whole, as a child, you become a ward of the whole group. So you're disciplined by everyone that's older than you. You're spanked by everyone. You're punished by everyone. You didn't have to wait till daddy got home, because the guy across the road would just give you a licking if you needed it. And it was horrific. And it's normal for them. So they don't see that as something wrong, but it was normal. But it is terribly wrong. And that was their only way of dealing with anything, was, you know, spare the rod, ruin the child, right?
Mm-hmm. And was there common for like teenagers to rebel, like yourself?
There were teenagers that rebelled. In fact, there was a couple that left before I did. They ended up coming back, or one of them came back. She never came back. He did. But there were some that played with, you know, toyed with leaving and coming back and leaving and coming back. The difference between me was, when I left, I never went back. And I determined that once I walked off that farm, I never, ever was going to go back. And I never did.
Were there some that did, like, leave for, like, a period of time and came back?
Yeah, there was some that left. There was some that left for a short period of time, and then they came back and, you know, dabbled a little bit. And they were allowed to come back, and mm-hmm. and as long as they were repentant and sorry. But I would have never gone back.
Was there any members that were ever, like, forced to leave the move?
There were members that were excommunicated that were told to leave. There were members from our farm that were, in one particular case, there was an elder. One of the elders had a sexual relationship with a younger girl. He was married and he had kids. And when it was discovered, they were forced to leave. But they weren't forced to leave the move. They were forced to move to another farm. And then it was brushed under the rug, and it disappeared. Nothing was done about it. It was just, let's get, you know, shuffle them around, and then everybody forgets it, and we don't talk about it anymore. It never happened. And that was very common in the move.
And were you involved, like, in support groups, like mentorship with people that had recently left the move, or anybody who left other cults, you know, to do, like,
I'm not in an actual group, but I do communicate. There's a lot of people that communicate with me, and there's a lot of people I talk to on the phone. There's a lot of people I've been on online chat groups where we've actually shared with each other. I've been on Zoom chats like we are right now. We're with as many as 15 to 20 people just talking about it and getting through that. So yes, and part of my next book is all about is a lot of that, where there's a group of us talking, not just myself, but we'll get four or five of us, and I take notes and I get permission to use their material and we talk about everything and what happened and how they're coping now, and it's really weird because a lot of them have been out of it for 25, 30, 40 years, and they still have nightmares and still can't sleep and still don't know how to deal with life. And even myself, I feel like I'm perfectly okay, but I've been in relationship after relationship that fails. I can't stay in a relationship. I don't know why. I feel like I'm a very well adjusted person, but that's one thing that I never learned. I never learned how to deal with that type of situation. And so for me right now, it's a world where everything is new for me still. And it's been how many years since I've left? I'm 60 now. And I left, like I said, I left when I was 15. So that's a lot of years. Mm-hmm. But these things affect you for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. Well, like when you met Sam 5, did he seem like seems like most of the cult leaders are very charismatic. Did he have like a certain aura about him?
You know what's funny is Sam Fife had an aura about him, and everybody just, like, you were in awe when he walked into the building. I don't know why. But when I actually met him face to face and spent 8 hours with him in a little minivan going from Edmonton up to Fort St. John, he was the most normal human being I'd ever met in my entire life. And we talked about everything pretty much except religion. We talked about fishing, and we talked about hunting, and we talked about flying planes because he had his own plane and I wanted to be a pilot. And he literally was the most normal person I'd ever met in my life. I couldn't understand it. I couldn't believe it. And yet behind that man, there was this controlling, unbelievable, powerful person that I don't know how he had that power. I just don't know where it came from. But I had no respect for him when I met him. And I had no respect for him afterwards, but he was this whole thing about Sam being this, you know, direct connection between God and man and stuff like that. When I met him, that left. I thought of him differently after that. And I wish everyone would have had the opportunity to spend some time with him, because they would have realized that he wasn't this big God that everybody thought he was.
Did you ever meet Buddy Cobb, who took over Fife's place after he had passed away or died in the?
Well, I was in the same room as him several times. I've never really spoken to him or met him in face to face, had conversation with him. I was just a kid when I was there, and they paid very little attention to kids. But I do know of Buddy Cobb very well. Yes.
Is there anybody now who's central to the group now?
You know, there was, but he passed away in a northern Canada area. There was a fellow by the name of Ernest Watkins that kind of was one of the lead guys up in the northern Canada. But he passed away a couple of years ago. So I really don't know who's in charge of anything now, because I know Buddy's gone now too. So who knows? I really don't know. I don't try to keep up to speed on what's going on inside the group anymore.
For your books, is there any audio book versions?
There is not yet, but I'm going to do an audio of that book and of the next book. Okay. I have been asked to do it many times, and I think I'm going to get that done, because it seems to be a popular way of getting the word out is audio. People love audio. So I definitely think we're going to do it in audio as well.
Do you want to share, like, what are some of the joys and challenges of being a writer in different genres?
Oh, I love writing because for me it's therapeutic. I have a very active mind. I constantly, even in work, I've got 11 projects going right now that I work for myself. I've got 11 projects on the go right now in Jamaica, Haiti, Grenada, different all over the place. In Toronto, I've got stuff going. So I have all these projects going because my mind is very busy. And I find that the only way that I can turn my mind off from work is to write. So I and it's great having a bunch of books on the go, because when I'm in a certain mood, I can write political stuff. When I'm in another mood, I'll write self-help. If I'm in another mood, then I'm going to write, a novel and get into the novels. So for me, it's just therapeutic. It's a way to keep my mind fairly busy all the time, which I just, when I'm not sleeping, I like to be busy, and it just works for me. So writing is my avenue for remaining happy, you know.
And what are the challenges of writing?
Well, the challenges are writer's block, but I found my way around that is the fact that if I can't write in one book in one genre, I just hop over to the other one and do something different. And so you can escape the writer's block if you're not focused on just one thing all the time. And so it works for me. It may not work for other people, but one of the other challenges that I find is that you find out that you start turning into a bit of a hermit, because I don't go out. I don't do much. I basically sit at home and I either work or write. So you don't socialize very much anymore. You start losing that part of your life. But I don't seem to be affected too much by that. I have lots of friends, so I'm not too worried about it.
So right now, are you like simultaneously working on just several books?
I'm actually simultaneously working on 13 different books right now.
Wow.
And one is ready for publishing. I've got 7 children's books that I've done that are ready for publishing. I just need to find someone who can do the illustrations, and that's difficult for some reason. I don't know why, but I have a great publisher and I have a really good publicist. I don't know. You've spoken with mm-hmm. Tracy mm-hmm. And she's been really good in connecting me with things like people like you and getting the word out there and getting the book out. We're going to do a public speaking tour eventually. I hope to do that. I hope to retire. I kind of made a commitment that I'm going to retire from my job on my 63rd birthday. So I've got less than 3 years to go. And then I want to do this full time. I want to do public speaking and get out on the road and do some speaking tour and sell some books. So it's kind of the plan.
Have some of your books been translated into other languages?
Not at this point. I actually have been asked to do it in French, and I've been asked to do it. I think I'm going to do it in Dutch as well. So this is my family is pretty well all from Holland. Mm-hmm. And I'm really thinking that I'd like to publish in Europe as well. So we'll probably do it in Dutch and we'll probably do it in French.
Wow. And I guess the current members of the MOVE, are they still I guess in Europe, there's still groups over there in Africa or South America?
Right. As far as I understand, there are still groups in Europe, South Africa, or in Africa, in South America, in the United States. There's lots in Alaska. Mm-hmm. But what they've done is they've amalgamated these farms, like the farm that I was on. The area where I was when I was there, there was 7 farms. There was 8 farms actually up there, and now there's only 3. So what they've done is they've just merged all the farms kind of together. They've sold off some of the land that was less productive and not as valuable, and they've downsized, but at the same time merged things together, right? So there's only I think there's far less farms now than there were before. There's probably just as much acreage. Mm-hmm.
And like your parents were like nominated as elders at one point. So is it those who were nominated as elders, or it's like kind of a seniority thing, or is it like how long you've been involved or how dedicated you are?
Well, it's really difficult to answer that question because I really don't know what the criteria was mm-hmm. to be an elder, because some of the elders that were elders shouldn't have been elders. Mm-hmm. but the thing is that my parents, my mom and dad were elders, but you have to understand that my dad purchased the land up there, the original farm up there. My dad purchased. Well, there were a couple of other farms, but the farm that we were on, my dad purchased it. And then over time, when more and more people moved onto it, eventually they asked my dad to leave, and my dad moved away, and they forced him to sign it over to them, using fear tactics, obviously. And that's another whole other story. But the thing is that my dad was an elder until about the time that he left. They ended up moving on to a small trailer park just out near the communities. When you were older and they had no use for you on the farm, they kind of farmed you out like an old stallion. You know, that's kind of the way it was. And then my dad was no longer an elder anymore, like mom and dad. So they took it away and they gave it to you at their convenience, whatever worked for them. So, but the elders generally were the hierarchy in the company was Sam Fife. Then there was the apostles, which were considered what they called the traveling ministry, that traveled around and taught and preached and brought new people in. And then there were the elders that were in charge of the individual groups. So the elders were the group that were kind of made all the rules and enforced all the rules on the farms and in the groups. So that was kind of how the hierarchy worked, right?
And in your book, you mentioned about like encounters with like wildlife at the different farms, like bears.
Oh yeah, well, where we lived was pretty remote. We had a lot of bears and we had a lot of coyotes and wolves it was really cool. I liked living there and I really enjoyed being out in the woods, and it wasn't uncommon to get on a horse and go for a long ride and out into the woods and just enjoy nature. And that part of it I actually miss.
Living on the farms as a kid, were there ever like any encounters of outsiders who just happened to stumble upon the farm, didn't know what it was?
Oh, there were definitely outsiders that would come in, and they would usually when they came in, it was really weird because it was like I'm going to just explain this from a reverse angle. When I went back to the farm, I was married and I had my first son. And it was the first time I took my wife up there to show her where I lived. And we drove in and it was like no one anywhere around, but you could see all the faces of all the people in the windows as they're all staring at you as you're driving in, like who is this? What are they doing here? That type of thing. And so, yes, we had outsiders come in and we treated them like that. I treated them like that. It was, who is this? What are they doing here? You know, someone would go talk to them and then they would leave, you know? So it was usually not a very long visit because no one was really welcome there, mm-hmm. unless we did have outsiders come in at one time that ended up, I remember a couple of guys that came in and they were from religious families but they came in to see the farms and they ended up staying. They ended up moving there. So, it was quite strange for outsiders. Yes. Outsiders were really not welcome.
When you were in the move, were there most of the people involved, like most Caucasian, or were there other races too?
There were other races. There was Asian and there were blacks and Asians. And mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously they were equivalent to the minority in the world today. I mean, there were a lot more whites than there were others, but no, there was no racism, I don't think, per se, in the move that I knew of. It was open to any race basically. Yeah.
Wow. Did you want to share any with the listeners of this podcast, any like any interesting or unusual stories, I guess, that you weren't able to cover in your book?
Actually, that's a good question. I don't, not so much of the farm itself, but there is one thing that I think is really important. And this is what I try to make sure that everybody understands, is that for those people that have left, it is really important to tell your story and get it out. But one of the side effects or one of the consequences of telling your story, and ironically, I found this with pretty much everyone I spoke to, is that you're going to have family and friends turn on you because the majority of people don't want you talking about it. And the reason you feel the way you do is because you've been taught that all your life. Don't talk about it. Don't talk about it. Keep it inside. Keep it inside. But My family, basically, none of my family talks to me anymore. They've abandoned me completely. I have kids that are wonderful, and they love me, and they're great. But I never had a close relationship with my family anyways, because when you're in the move, family became very unimportant. And it just was something that just didn't matter that much. And so this book just basically tipped it the other way, where now there's really no one that talks to me anymore. But I found that almost everyone that I talk to that has spoken about their experiences, their family abandons them. And that's very, very common. So you have to reach out to the other people that you have things in common with. Mm-hmm. And you'll find you do have a lot of support. I have a lot of support. It's unbelievable the amount of support that I have. And I in turn give that to other people. So it's about just talking, sharing. Don't be afraid. If there is a hell, it's not what you were told it is. If there's a heaven, it's not what you were told it is. If there is a God, he's not what you were told he is. It's a completely, just stop living in that world of where you're worried about where you're going to go when you die. Just worry about where you are now.
I really liked the poem you had at the end of your book, I Paint a Picture. So I guess, have you written any books of poetry?
I've written hundreds of poems. I apparently have a great-great-great-great-grandfather who is a published poet. I didn't know that until a fellow from Holland contacted me, and he sent me a book, and I've got it here in my archive somewhere. That is all poetry written by a great-great-grandfather of mine, and it's all in Dutch, so I don't really understand it. But I've got that, and it's kind of cool to know that. But yes, I've written a lot of poetry, and that particular poem, my mother loved that poem, and so that poem is really special to me because of that. But it also is a very emotional, and it really kind of I try to get people to go into their dream world and see something other than just the negative stuff in life. You know, there's beauty, and you just have to close your eyes and see it. And that's what that poem is about. So yes, I do write poetry. I love poetry. So,
and what does your own children think of your experiences being in a move? You shared a lot, like what you went through.
My children, they totally get it. They totally understand it all. I've told them everything. They're totally they accepted my mom and dad the way they were, and they've not been judgmental at all. My children are bothered by the fact that none of the family has anything to do with us. They feel that that's very unfair, but it's the way it is. And they accept that too. And they try really hard. My one son tries really hard to patch things up with everybody all the time. He's a peacemaker, and but my kids have adjusted to life very well. I have three wonderful boys. One is in upper management in a fairly successful company. He also has his own IT company. And then my middle son is a journeyman welder. And then my younger son is still in university. He's in his fourth year right now. Very proud of these boys. They've done very well. They've adjusted to the world very well. Two of them are married, great relationships. But I don't have any grandkids. Mm-hmm. So it's all good. Our life is very well adjusted. It's very normal for us now. This doesn't affect me really in my day-to-day life at all anymore. I'm having so much fun with life. It's unbelievable. So I can't imagine what it would have been like for me if I'd never gone through something like this. But maybe going through that is what made me what I am today. So I don't know.
I would look forward to reading this second part of your memoir, Richard.
I will get that to you when I get it through the publisher. I haven't sent it to my editor yet, but as soon as I get that done, I'll get you a copy of the manuscript.
Well, thank you, and I hope your books continue to inspire, other readers and people that were also involved in cults, to help them adjust better once they leave and get back into society.
Right. Well, absolutely. That's the purpose. That was the reason that I decided to publish it, because I actually wrote it just for therapy. And then after I wrote it, I thought, geez, I need to publish this. And I had other people read it and tell me, you've got to get this published. And then I made a commitment that I wouldn't publish it till after my mom and dad passed away. And so I waited till dad passed away, which is about four or five years ago now. and 4 years ago, I guess. And then I went ahead and started looking for a publisher, and I got it done. And you know, it's a good read for people that have been through something like this, because the biggest thing is you'll learn to understand that you're not alone, and your circumstances and situations were very similar. Every single person that I interviewed, the similarities of what happened to them, how they were treated, and how they've handled it as adults, is exactly the same. Mm-hmm. It's just repetitive. It doesn't matter what religion or what cult they came out of. It's all the same. The treatment of children is almost the same in every cult. Mm-hmm. The treatment of adults is the same in every cult. The hierarchy is always the same. There's always one person at the top that's the ultimate power. Everybody worships that person. And yet they're usually a very elusive person. They're usually not someone that spends a lot of time. Like Sam Fife never lived on a farm, and he never would have. He wasn't cut out for that. But he sure made his people do it, you know?
Yeah, there's like you said, like people were forced to move further and further into the wilderness because you thought the apocalypse was going to come any time.
Yeah, it was. The second book explains that a little bit more. It was a theory that Sam Fife had called moving deeper in, and it was about moving further and further into the forest and into the wilderness and into the bush, where it would be harder for you to be found, and it would be harder for you to have communication with the outside world. And it was about learning how to take care of yourself and live off of nature, completely off of nature. We were supposed to get down. In fact, when I was on the farm, we actually got to a point where the basics that were bought in town were basically sugar and salt. And pretty well everything else was generated on the farm itself. So that changed later, but because they had more money after I left, they started a few businesses, and they actually started generating some income, and then they were able to afford more stuff. But it was pretty destitute when I was there.
Do you have an official website?
I don't anymore. I did. I'm just getting it. I have a website person that's working on a new one for me right now. But I'm also going to be setting up a blog. So we're going to have a full-time blog running. Right now, though, I am on Facebook, and I can be found on Facebook under my real name. the book is available online as well. So you can get it at Barnes & Noble, Amazon. It's available in e-reader, four different formats of e-reader. So it's very available out there for people that want to get at it. It's a Swindled by Faith. It's an interesting book. I've had a lot of religious people have a negative response to it because they didn't take the time to read the book. They just saw the title and figured, mm-hmm. oh, that's bad. It's an anti-religious mm-hmm. book. It's not an anti-religious book at all. It basically is about that specific religion and how faith was used to control us. And that's what the book is all about. It's really about that. I'm not anti-religious. I'm not anti-God at all. I'm not a religious person myself. But I understand that there are people that need that in their life, and it's fine if they have that. I don't have a problem with that at all. My belief doesn't impact anybody else's belief. So,
hello, thanks for listening to the Erratic Dispatches podcast. We'll be back shortly after a brief break. Thanks again for tuning in to this latest episode of the Erratic Dispatches podcast, featuring an interview with Richard Kears discussing his book Swindled by Faith. I posted links on the profile page for this podcast, in which you can purchase Richard's book and also check out the documentary, The Movement of God from Discovery. That's on YouTube. There's also a contribution button located on my Anchor FM page, in which any kind of donation would be greatly appreciated, since I'm always striving to make my podcast better. Thanks again for listening. I'll be back soon with a new episode. Take care. Bye-bye.